Spring is here, and you can now get almost anything you need for your sunny days delivered with Uber Eats. What do we mean by almost? Well, you can't get a well-groomed lawn delivered, but you can get a chicken parmesan delivered. A cabana? That's a no. But a banana? That's a yes. A nice tan? Sorry. Nope. But a box fan? Happily, yes. A day of sunshine? No. A box of fine wines? Yes. Uber Eats can definitely get you that. Get almost anything delivered with Uber Eats. Order now. Alcohol in select markets. Product availability may vary by region. See app for details.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Some families we're born into. Some families are made from the ones we meet along the way. Our families are built on love and traditions, the memories we share, and knowing that life is better because we're together. Pure Life, 100% pure quality water, refreshing every moment together. Visit purelifewater.com and discover where to buy Pure Life.
To the Analyst Inside Cricket. We've been taking a little pause for a couple of weeks, but we're back, Simon and me, together, just as England are heading off on another tour to Sri Lanka. It feels like you've only been back a few days from South Africa, and off they go again.
Well, I have only been back for a few days from South Africa, and off they go again. I'm not going to Sri Lanka for a couple of weeks, but it just makes you realise how much the players are away. Now, not everyone is away all 6 months or so of the winter, but there's been a lot of cricket this winter and a lot of players have played an enormous amount of it. But off they go again. World Test Championship points at stake. With England needing to, you know, climb up that table and put pressure on the top two.
They've slipped down to fourth place now, having climbed to third because of the New Zealand defeat of India. So we'll look at that series in a bit. And I suppose we should just also say, in a way, the fact that England are off again goes back to the podcast that I did a couple of weeks ago about the mental health of cricketers, and several of the people, the contributors to that programme, saying that it's the stress of constantly being away, constantly on tour, constantly living out of suitcases, and not only playing, but training with your teammates, being kind of under scrutiny, even on your sort of days when you're not actually playing. And I know Crick Info did every year they do a kind of who is the busiest cricketers in the world. Joe Root is always up there in like 140 days of cricket. And it might not sound that much, but then if you add all those training days and all those travel days as well, it's around about 300 days away from home. So you've only got 60 days actually in your home in a whole year, which is it's pretty hard.
Yeah, 60 days of normal life a year.
And even those days will be sponsors, assignments, selection meetings, promotional stuff. You know, how often he actually sees his little boy and his wife, I don't know, except I suppose they can go on tour with
him. They do come out. I said to Jos Buttler in an interview just before we left South Africa, he made some runs in the last T20 in the match with England. One dramatic game, really exciting game. A fantastic series that was, that T20 series. I know we haven't had a chance to discuss it, but it was a wonderful series, full of thrilling cricket and lots of attacking play. But anyway, he made a half century in the last match. And he hasn't had a great time of it over the winter. He struggled in the South African Test series. And I said to him, what do you do now? Do you go back and do you work on your batting before you go to Sri Lanka? And he said, no, I just need to get away from cricket, you know, and then come back and start playing cricket again once I get to Sri Lanka. And you can understand that. You know, some players, I think, would have gone away and practiced and perhaps worked on their game, but you do need to get away from it. They play so much cricket. You do have to switch off, and switching off and not playing is almost as important as practising.
Yeah, and someone like Buttler, of course, his batting has been under the microscope so much, and you're ending up tinkering with your game just a little bit to try and eradicate slight flaws. There's so much analysis, isn't there, that you can be almost paralysed by it. So actually, I can quite see why you just need to chill out and go and play football or something, just for a bit.
Not football, I get injured playing football.
Yes, that's true.
But what they have done is they've given themselves a bit of time to prepare for the first test match. Really sapping conditions in Sri Lanka. The first test is 2 weeks on Thursday. England are arriving on Tuesday in Sri Lanka. So they've given themselves 2.5 weeks, basically, to prepare for the first test match, which, you know, seems, I don't know, I've thought about it really, but it seems like quite a long time to prepare for the first test. It's only a two-match series, of course, and vital games for them. You feel that Sri Lanka are vulnerable, but also they could be quite handy in their home conditions, definitely. And I think it would be a very different series from the one that was played last time, with perhaps the pitches not necessarily offering as much spin as last time.
And the weather as well was absolutely appalling, wasn't it? So in fact, the one-day series, I think, the weather was appalling when you were in Sri Lanka, wasn't it? It was raining all the time.
Yeah, it rained a lot.
This is a different time of year, so the March weather should be decent in Sri Lanka.
Well, it'll be fine in terms of, you know, dryness, but it'll be sapping. It'll be high humidity, really hot. I think Sri Lanka's the hottest place I've ever been.
I agree.
You've played there, haven't you?
Well, I played there, and actually I used to pour liquid over me rather than drink it, because I just literally was so hot. Yeah. And that was a stupid thing to do, because pouring sticky sweet liquid attracts all sorts of insects. So I remember once looking down at my trousers, actually, and they were covered in red ants, where the sort of sticky orange juice had sort of tailored to the bottom of my trousers, and I had a lot of red ants running up my legs. Mm. So that's another little thing to deal with. They have snakes around the edge of the ground as well, don't they, in Sri Lanka?
They
lots of little things to deal with.
Yeah, lots of things to avoid, I would say. Yeah. I remember playing a game of volleyball, and the ball went over into the bushes somewhere, and then suddenly I saw something whipping away. It was a snake that had been dislodged by the volleyball.
You probably don't like snakes.
No, I don't. I'm not keen on snakes. But I'm looking forward to going to Sri Lanka. It would be an interesting test for England because of the conditions, because I think it will be a bit different from last time. And I don't see the potency in their spin attack quite the same as they had last time. They had Moeen, they had Rashid, they had Leach. I mean, Jack Leach has had a really tough winter. Illness in New Zealand, struggled in South Africa. It's reportedly got a slight calf problem. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hasn't bowled as much as he'd like to have done over the winter. And there's a lot resting on him and Don Bess, who's a relative novice, and then Matt Parkinson, if he can get into the side. So I don't see the England spin threat quite in the same way as the last time they were there.
And also, there's a chance it'll be flatter pitches, isn't there? Because they made the mistake of making turning pitches before on every spinner turned the ball, however good or bad you were. So that gave England the opportunity to force the initiative. This time, you'll need good spin to be able to exploit the conditions. I think Bess showed some good signs in South Africa. I mean, he wasn't a particularly good bowler when he first played for England a couple of years ago, but he's definitely improved, and he's not the finished article by any means. But a combination of him and Jack Leach, if he can keep the control, would be decent, I think, with a Sri Lanka side that are evolving themselves.
Somerset against Sri Lanka, it'll be, won't it? It will be. Bess and Leach. And Bess was saying the other day that actually, when Leach has been successful, he's sort of not been in the side. And when he's been successful or done well, been to the fore, Leach has not been in the side. It's not often that they've been able to play together for England, you know, to be the focal point for England together. So, yeah, big test for both of those.
But the key, of course, is to make runs. Yeah. If England make enough runs, it almost doesn't matter who you got to bowl. If you've got people who can just keep it tight, wickets will fall, score ball pressure. So England's emphasis will be on trying to make big runs. That was the blueprint for winning those test matches in South Africa, and that's what they've got to apply again this time. They've gone down to fourth place, England, in the championship, as I said. New Zealand sneaking up to third. It's quite a sort of strange looking...
Well, more than sneaking. It was a little bit unfair, isn't it?
Well, I say sneaking,
they've just beaten the world number one team comprehensively in two test matches.
I know, but they have only won 3 tests out of 7, whereas England have won 5 out of 9, and they're 40 points behind. Mm. It's that sort of strange, at the moment, anomaly of the World Test Championship, which is sort of gradually evening up over time, because you get more points available pro rata for a 2-test series than you do for a 5-test series.
Well, that's the point about England's series in Sri Lanka, actually. It's really right, you know, on each test match, isn't it? The focus on each test match is really intense. It's not over the series like in South Africa, we have a chance to come back. it's right, you've got to do it in that first test match, because that test match is worth 60 points in the World Test Championship. So England have the chance to take up 120 points in the same way that New Zealand have just done against India.
Which if they did get those, it would take them to round about 260. So sort of closer to India. At the moment, there's a big gap, India, Australia and the rest. Mm. But it will just even that gap up a little bit, especially with India now picking up no points from that series.
Yeah. I don't mind the focus on specific test matches or two test match series. People say, it's no real contest over two test matches. Well, I think it is. I think it's really making every single day of the series count. We've been so used to in the past having four or five match series, you get the chance to come back. And that's fascinating in itself. The Ashes last summer, for example, and the series in South Africa where England were able to come back. But there's also something about making the day count, really seizing the initiative in that first test match, something that England have not really been that good at in recent years. So I think that's it's a different sort of challenge. It's a more intense challenge, but I don't think it's diminished by the fact that it's just two test matches.
It's interesting, this general home advantage influence. If you look at obviously, India, who always win their test matches at home. Australia annihilated New Zealand at home. Mm. And now New Zealand have annihilated India at home. And they were mismatches, weren't they, in the end?
Yeah.
India just couldn't get any runs.
Well, the pitch in Christchurch, I've been watching some of the pitch in Christchurch, it was green and it swung. Trent Bolt today was getting the ball to swing. It was overcast, the pitch was green and it was swinging.
Memories of that time when he bowled England out for about 60.
Yeah.
Or was it 80?
58.
God. And that really did swing.
Yeah, and you've got that huge contrast between playing in India where pitches are dry and slow, and that those Indian batsmen are so used to those conditions and dominating those conditions, and then they've got something completely different when they go to New Zealand. It's a bit like when they come to England as well, where the ball nips around, and it really does test that technique.
And we've had Rahul Dravid and others, haven't we, on this programme in the past, talking about India trying to conquer the world in Test cricket and what chances have they got. And he's always said, actually, that in white ball cricket, more chance, because in red ball cricket, the ball does move so much more, and it's hard.
Especially away from home,
and especially in England and New Zealand. And it's hard getting those young batsmen to apply themselves. And, what he always loves that phrase, I'd love a good leave. Why doesn't a modern batsman love a good leave? Mm. I used to love a good leave. You don't get too many leaves from the Prithvi Shaws and Agarwals of the modern game, do you, opening the batting for India? But you have to, otherwise you don't survive. And Kohli was quite adamant in his press conference after the series that they weren't positive enough, the Indians, in their defence as much as they were in attack. You can be positive in defence by deliberately leaving the ball and being very clear in your mindset. I'm not going to play anything which is a foot outside off stump. Being very, very clinical, and that's what they weren't.
Well, as a bowler, if someone leaves well, that must be really frustrating,
isn't it? And then you try over hard to bowl straighter and overcompensate. And you bowl leg stump and you bowl hard volleys or easy balls to put away on the leg side. So he does. There was a player a long time ago now, actually, but John Wright, opening batsman for New Zealand and Derbyshire, and his simple philosophy about batting was, know where your off stump is, leave everything in the first 10 overs, just outside off stump, make bowlers bowl to your strength on the legs. Alistair Cook, another one. But Wright was brilliant at that. He hardly ever played a shot on the offside, and he just hit everything on the leg side, and bowlers do overcompensate. So if you can be really disciplined, that's the thing that separates, the real test stars from everyone else, the sort of dilettantes, because, if you have to be really disciplined. I think Root is gradually getting there now. He doesn't really like leaving the ball, does he? He likes flirting with those shots, looking for those runs on the offside behind square, opening the face. But I think I've seen just one or two little signs of the last few tests in South Africa where he really did apply his discipline around the off stump. And maybe, he's now going to sort of go on the upward path to prosperity again.
Did you hate bowling at John Wright? for that reason, that he was a good leader?
Yes, I did, because it was frustrating, actually. You would try too hard to make... You'd see that very, very fine judgment of a ball just outside off something. He was left-handed, so, you know, I was looking to try and swing it back to him. And if it was just starting a little bit too wide outside off, he'd leave it alone, and it might just, you know, shave the offside... off stump by a couple of inches, 2-3 inches, and you'd think, oh, you know, that was close. Right, I'll get another one a bit straighter. And inevitably, you started a bit straighter and it swings into his pads 4 runs or two or something. So it is very frustrating bowling at those sort of batsmen, and especially when you see how very disciplined and regimented they are, because you can't seem to get under their skin.
How do you think England will get on in Sri Lanka? We talked about last time England winning 3-0 with that, you know, what feels like to me a stronger spin attack.
I mean, obviously Sibley has trouble against spin, left arm spin, because he comes across the ball. I think that he's got good discipline, but he's definitely got a weakness outside off stump. He's got to really apply himself to leave the ball. And I would try and get him LBW early on as well. I'd try and get him sort of across the crease and then try and fire one up quick enough at middle and leg and try and get him playing across it to LBW. Whether the Sri Lankans have got good enough bowlers to exploit that, I don't know. Zach Crawley, I think, has a similar issue with sort of playing at balls outside off stump and getting drawn to playing them. He doesn't really move his feet well. I don't think he uses reach very well. So those two, I think, are a little bit vulnerable. The rest of the batting order, well, from there, you know, Root, Stokes, Ollie Pope, fantastic. Mm. As good as anyone in the world, those three. So, you know, provided those openers can just protect them against a new ball, and obviously we don't know quite how Ollie Pope will go against spin, but those three guys are absolute class. And Ollie Pope could be the one-time, all-time leading run scorer for England if he... It's a long shot, that. It's a bit of a kind of big call, but, I mean, he's got...
No pressure.
He's got the game. Yeah. He's definitely got the game to be as good as Root. Mm.
Well, he started extremely well, hasn't he? He's shown a lot of promise very early on. He's been picked at a young age and, you know, generally speaking, those players that go on and play 100 test matches, they often make their debut at sort of 20, 21. You don't see many people go on a really, really successful career who, you know, get picked at 25, 26. So it's generally the class players are the ones that get picked young, you know, the likes of Root and Cook and David
Gower. And
David
you have
Gower.
To get picked young to make that quantity of runs, because if you're only starting at 26, 27, you've lost sort of 4 or 5 years of... you know, making maybe 500-600 runs in a calendar year. So you're going to be well behind the rest. I mean, I did a little bit of an analysis on the greatest run scorers of all time and when they scored their first 100, and most of them scored their first 100 in their first 5 to 6 innings in Test cricket under the age of 23. Pope was the second youngest, I think, for England, wasn't he, to make 100? Cook was the youngest, and Pope was just a touch older than Cook when he made his first Test 100. So, you know, very impressive. Big, big future.
Yeah. Well, that's the men. World Test Championship points. Congratulations to New Zealand. England looking to take 120 points, if possible, from Sri Lanka. The women are involved in the World T20 down under in Australia. It seems to me the tournament has got more coverage than ever before. It's growing. The interest is there. It's growing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I watched the first game, actually, Australia-India, and you know, brilliant crowd. Yeah. There was more people at that game. It was at the Sydney Showgrounds, which is a big bash venue.
It's where the Sydney Thunder play.
And there were more people than for some of the Sydney Thunder games. There was something like 15,000 crowd. Admittedly, it was the opening game. Mm. I think it was a Friday night. But, you know, definitely good attendance. And there was a real spirit about the crowd, I felt, as well. There was really engaged. Rather than being sort of token turning up, oh, we better turn up, it's the first game, there was real enthusiasm and passion there. And some brilliant cricket. The young leg spinner for India, who was bowling, I swear to you, 35 miles an hour, but had the most brilliant control of her leggies and googlies, and bowled Elise Perry, first ball through the gate. She was on a hat-trick. It was just a lovely bit of mesmerising spin. Perry, of course, is now potentially out.
Yeah.
She's got injured. She's Australia's... I mean, when you talk about great cricketers of the last 10 years in the world, Lise Perry's got to be there, hasn't she? As much as, you know, talking about the men all the time, we tend to forget someone like her who's made double hundreds and is an opening bowler and has been so consistent for Australia in all formats. She's going to be out of a big semi-final, whoever it's against. It could be against England. That potentially could give England a huge advantage. Such an influential player. England themselves, I feel, haven't quite got their batting sorted. They can't quite figure out that the best order. They've tried Amy Jones at the top. And with Danny Wyatt, now they've dropped Amy Jones down into the middle order and put Tammy Beaumont back up to the top. T20 puts teams in an interesting dilemma with their opening batsmen, because that theoretically is the time when you want to cash in, the power play, the six overs, when there's only two men out. That's the time when you think, right, we need to get 50 or 60 runs off those first six overs. Therefore, I need to send my best hitters in. But actually, sometimes the most difficult overs to bat are kind of 14 to 20, or even in the middle overs. So you actually want your real batting maestros batting in those middle overs or even at the death, where obviously there's more fielders on the boundary. And actually it's easier batting in those first six overs because there's hardly anybody out on the boundary. So if you've just got people who can hit the ball reasonably cleanly, you don't necessarily want to throw all your might into those first six overs. You want to keep some of those really skilled batters back for the last five overs can be the difference in making 120 and 150. And that 150 in the women's game is a winning score.
What about the configuration of the tournament, or the, you know, how the tournament's panned out? Last time the West Indies made the semi-finals, this time it's South Africa. If you go back to the last World Cup, I know we're talking about 50 overs, the same teams made the semi-finals in the 50-over tournament has made the semi-finals in this women's T20. How are the rest doing?
Coming up slowly. Pakistan definitely are better than they were. New Zealand, I'm surprised they're not in the semis. I mean, they're always a competitive team. They always have very good players like Sophie Devine playing in the Super League in England, who are always dominant. Rachel Priest as well. So, and they're fit, you know, they're reasonably fit. I think fitness is quite a big thing in the women's game, becoming so more, as it is obviously in the men's game. Spin also, and that's where England are good, because someone like Sophie Eccleston has got excellent control, and she's a proper spinner, really does give the ball a bit of a rip, and it sort of zips and curves out of her hand beautifully. Spin is quite a key ingredient, as it is in the men's game. In the women's game, the spinners, the control of the spinners, especially on those slightly bigger grounds in Australia, is the key to it.
I sense that there's a strong feeling for Australia to get to the final, so that the crowd at the MCG for the final next Sunday is a vast one. They've sold 50,000 tickets last I heard. I mean, they want to get it up as many as possible. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether people are that partisan that if they've got a ticket in Australia and not in the final, they won't go. I don't know. But you sort of feel Australia probably need to be in the final, or it would help the tournament if Australia were
in
the final.
And they should be, shouldn't they? Because they've got, I think, 100 professional women's players, whereas, you know, England have got, 20 or something, and most of the other countries about the same. So, you know, they've got a better professional structure. And let's hope, actually, for the women's game, that Australia do get to the final, because, yeah, they and India are probably the two best teams. England, I mean, that's perhaps a bit unfair. I mean, let's say those three sides are the best teams. And for the women's game to, say, half or three quarters fill out the MCG, that is a real defining moment for women's cricket.
Yeah. Well, don't forget South Africa. They did take down England earlier in the tournament.
I think England lost that rather than South Africa won it, really. Right, well, we're now going to talk a little bit about schools cricket, actually. And it features a former Lancashire and England fast bowler. What made me think of this is that the news over the weekend, Mark Wood, unfortunately, failed a fitness test, so he's not going to Sri Lanka. And he's been replaced by Saqib Mahmood of Lancashire and England now. And a man with a very similar name, Saj Mahmood, I encountered very recently, a former Lancashire and England fast bowler. I encountered him coaching at a state school in Greenford in West London and pioneering really quite an interesting initiative. This is a state school, William Perkin, and they've developed an elite cricket academy, which Saj Mahmood is the head coach of. And what they're basically doing is they've created this fantastic facility, which is a former corporate cricket ground. I think it belonged to GlaxoSmithKline a while ago, just on the M40, A40 going out of London. Lovely cricket ground there, which the school have built on. They've created a school, a new school, with fantastic sports facilities, indoor school, 4G pitch for football and hockey and all sorts of other things, this cricket pitch and cricket nets. And they're focusing on creating this elite cricket academy so that you can actually do an A-level almost in cricket. You do obviously do academic subjects alongside, but they're actually tailoring the syllabus so that you do your subjects pretty much in the mornings and you do cricket, all its ramifications, all the different departments of cricket, you know, both batting, bowling, fielding, but also fitness, tactics, things like that, different seminars on different areas of the game in the afternoons, which is quite an inspiring idea and something which they're hoping this school will catch on with other schools.
I would have loved to have done an A-level in cricket.
Yeah.
And an O-level, and just play cricket all afternoon, every day of the year, summer, winter, whatever. Fantastic. And this is in a state school?
This is in a state school, brand new school, been there about 10 years, I think. The inspiration for it is Keir Smith, who is the headmaster, who's just a cricket-loving headmaster, who wanted to see more encouragement given to state school kids who hadn't got the opportunity to play all that much cricket. There's a lot of cricket clubs around the school as well who are making use of the facilities sort of at weekends or in the evenings. But the focus is on finding kids from primary schools, state primary schools, who haven't perhaps had the opportunity to play all that much cricket. Saj is going round, sort of in the West London area, finding budding players, people who show an interest, to try and tempt them into perhaps coming to William Perkin in the sixth form to do this specialist A-level.
Saj Mahmood played 38 times for England. You might remember. Let's hear from him.
The academy will just hit every single aspect of the game. The physical stuff and the tactical awareness, the leadership qualities, they can always take that. Not if they don't progress and play county cricket or become a professional cricketer, they can always take it into a working environment in whichever field they sort of choose to go into.
So you're stressing kind of academics in the morning and sport stroke cricket in the afternoon, which is quite an unusual arrangement for a state school.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, I wish I had that when I was a bit younger as well. A lot of the times you do school from 9 till 3 or 9 till 4, and then you've got to figure out a time where you can go and then practice, in this instance, cricket. And that could be like 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, whereas at this school, they're actually getting that within school time, which I think is brilliant and it clearly works. It doesn't really affect the academic side of stuff.
What are you finding in your time in primary schools in terms of sporting ability of the kids that you meet?
It's quite limited. I've spoke to a few teachers in the year and a half that I've been here, and a lot of them I've said, what do primary school teachers normally do for sport? And the one came up with that they just go for a walk for an hour, which is not really improving anything other than it's a bit of walking. So for me to go into primary schools, and we've got another a rugby coach at the school and a football guy at the school as well, for us guys to get into primary schools and just deliver specific sports and technical side of stuff at a very basic level, I think it puts them children in a very good place. Again, hand-eye coordination, just to understand the game at a basic level for when they come into secondary school, I think is a fantastic place for them to be. Also, not many people speak about it. Obviously, it's a teen sport, so it's not just the skills you learn technically. It's how you then can work in a team environment, what you need to do to succeed in a team environment, and you're giving them them sort of softer skills that they can then take away from sport and use in the wider life.
You said you wished you'd had that yourself when you were younger. So what was your sort of cricketing experience in primary school and that age?
Primary school, non-existent, if truth be told. Even though it was a long time ago, it was non-existent. Secondary school, we played fixtures. Coaching-wise, again, non-existent at all. I come from a state school as well, and there was no coaching whatsoever. We'd do a bit of football in PE, And then we'd have a cricket fixture on in the middle of the week. And that was about it, really. So I think what the school, and especially Keir's got this massive vision of bringing cricket into the school, I think is fantastic, because it just allows state schools to then have access to that sort of stuff. And hopefully if we can do this well and grow it nicely, we can then be an example to other state schools to just sort of roll this sort of programme out.
So that's Saj Mahmood, the head coach at William Perkin Elite Cricket Academy. He's sharing a flat with Ajmal Shahzad, another former England fast bowler who's now the MCC head coach. And together they're looking out for the next young talent in London. They have a bit of a tie-up with the MCC and Middlesex and the women as well. So the women are going to use, the women and girls are going to use the facilities at William Perkin on a Sunday, which will give the Middlesex women a bit of a sort of headquarters to kind of develop their game. It's interesting though, wasn't it, hearing Saj saying there that, you know, he goes around the schools and asks them what sort of sports they're doing, what PE they're doing, and some of them are doing walking, and that classifies as sport.
Yeah.
It's quite depressing.
It is. I mean, my experience of it with my children is that if you want to do sport, it all has to be done outside of school. And my children have been in the state system, and you know you have to join a club, you have to whatever it might be, whether it's swimming or netball or athletics. Those are sports that they did. No, you have to go outside of the school. There's a bit in school, but not that much.
In fact, if I think back to my own school days, which I know is, you know, pre-war almost, but primary school, my dad was the person who got us to play. He used to come to pick us up, and it was a great advantage having a father who didn't do a sort of regular job. So he was an actor, so he would often work in the evenings, so he had the day free. So he'd come to school with a big estate car, and we'd all pile in the back and drive to Gunnersbury Park, and we had our own little spot, and we'd play cricket in Gunnersbury Park. No school cricket at all, at primary level.
Yeah, and this is going back a long time now, but, you know, in the 70s, I was lucky enough to go to a state primary school, where the headmaster and one of the senior teachers were both cricket nuts. You mentioned there Keir Smith being a cricket fanatic, and, you know, it seems if it's come down to that, doesn't it? There are people who are interested in it will drive this forward, and you know that's where I got my love of playing cricket, of enjoyment from cricket, is because I was encouraged by two people who love the game, you know, who put cricket on, who we didn't have great facilities, but they wanted cricket to be played, and that's where you learnt it from the age of seven. That was my first experience of playing cricket at the age of seven, from two teachers who are massive enthusiasts.
And actually my kids have got their enthusiasm from a woman teacher who just turned up out of the blue, loved cricket herself, and came to the school in the mornings at 8 o'clock in the morning, state primary, and did the cricket lessons in the morning. And she did that completely off her own back. It wasn't part of the syllabus. It was just something she wanted to do. And that got their interest, or fueled their interest, which I obviously helped to develop. But you do need people to get these kind of initiatives going. And so congratulations to Keir Smith in particular for getting that going at William Perkin. He's now moving on to a new school in Ealing on the site of Barclays Bank, where Middlesex used to have their pre-season training, actually, and a new school is being built there, and he's hoping to try and do the same thing. I've also been, actually, to the Brian Aldridge Cricket Centre down in Sussex, just outside Brighton, and they're doing the same thing there. There's a state school with fantastic cricketing facilities. We went down there as a cricketer mob, actually, the Cricketer magazine, to do some bat testing, and met Georgia Adams, that's Chris Adams' daughter, who's the sort of head coach down there. So, you know, there is sort of these stirrings of initiatives in state schools for cricket, which is great to see. If you want more details on the Elite Cricket Academy at the William Perkin, by the way, you can get it online. And what they're looking for are kids, girls and boys, who are really interested in developing their cricket and can go to a sixth form where, by the way, academically, William Perkin is sort of top 10 in the country, state schools, for their academics, but they're really putting this focus on cricket as well. OK, well, that's it for this week. Good luck to England in the World Cup T20 semi-final, whoever they play. And we'll be back next week, where we're going to talk about the art of commentary.
Or the practice of commentary. I'm not sure necessarily talk about the art of commentary, but perhaps the practice of commentary, what it's like to be in the commentary box, what you're trying to do as a commentator, how you prepare for your day, and what that day is like. We'll try and take you inside the radio and the television commentary box.
Speak to you then. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.